newcollegefilm.com. Coming up right now, the progressive page turner. Marianne Barisonek interviews the author of a book titled How We Win the Civil War. Stay tuned.
You are listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. You can find us on the web at WSLR.org. The views and opinions expressed by hosts, guests, and callers on WSLR programs are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of WSLR, its staff, or volunteers. This is the Progressive Page Turner. I'm Marianne Barisonek. On this program, we'll talk about books with the people who wrote them. Issues confronting us today didn't spring up overnight. In his book, How We Win the Civil War, Steve Phillips makes the argument that the divisions we see today have their roots all the way back to the Civil War. To really understand the conflicts of today, we need to recognize what wasn't historically resolved. The book is divided into two parts. The first part goes over some history. The history is important because we need to examine the world white supremacists want to bring back. It's one where theft, murder, rape, and, yes, pedophilia can be committed by the favored class with impunity. The second part is how we secure a multiracial democracy. Steve, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
I have to admit, when I first saw the title of your book, I assumed you were referencing a new civil war. But what you're saying is the first civil war never effectively dealt with white supremacy, and it's at the heart of Trump conservatism. And until we understand how deep those roots go, we won't be able to effectively conquer it.
Right. So when my publisher, New Press, came to me in 2020 asking me about that I want to write another book, I did pose the framework of looking at things through a civil war in terms of the level of intensity. This was the first Trump administration. There was so much hostility and division and the country being divided and set against one another that I proposed using the framework of civil war as a way to try to understand what was happening at that time. The more I got into writing the actual book and digging into the Civil War and the aftermath, et cetera, it became clear that the actual Civil War in this country, that the Confederates have never stopped fighting it. And that, like, everybody knows, right, obviously Lincoln was assassinated, but I didn't even know until I was researching the book that Lincoln was assassinated 5 days after the purported end of the Civil War. And he was assassinated by an avowed white supremacist, nationalist, Confederate sympathizer in terms of John Wilkes Booth. He had heard Lincoln give a speech days before, right after the surrender of the Civil War, and he says, that means N-word citizenship. That's the last speech he will ever give. And so you take that forward. The rise of the Ku Klux Klan was created by former members of the Confederacy. There was a statue created, a large statue in Richmond, to Jefferson Davis before there was a statue of Abraham Lincoln in this country. And so this resistance of the defenders of the Confederacy on this notion that this should primarily be a white country and not a multiracial democracy has continued apace since the ostensible end of the Civil War in 1865.
One part of American history that is never taught honestly in American schools is about the Klan. Reading your book, I got a better sense of how extensive and truly blood-drenched the era of the Klan was. Can you go over some of the numbers of people murdered by them and how extensive the Klan membership was?
Yes, we don't appreciate that at all. It's kind of seen just like as this marginalized entity and whatnot. So what I was saying, it was literally created 6 months after the end of the Civil War. Congress had hearings about the extent. And so you had a couple thousand people being killed in a fairly short period of time, the only way to describe it is, in fact, white domestic terrorism. And there was a very conscious effort to intimidate and to stop people from participating in the electoral process, and to which you all actually had to do, because that's not even very clear from the historical record as well. At the end of the Civil War, you had South Carolina and Mississippi in particular that were majority black states. And so if they were going to try to preserve white power, they had to stop people from voting. And so a lot of the way they did that, and what I talk about in the book, as sanctioning domestic terrorism. There were, across the South, multiple levels of attack, beating people, and actual outright murder. So you had a couple thousand people in a small period of time who had actually been murdered. The Congress actually had looked into that. And so that would be like the equivalent, Floyd, every week in terms of the level of attack and terrorism that was actually going on. So you have that reality. And then there was a treasure trove of documents that came out like in the 1920s. This is another thing, the level of the power of the Klan. They basically blocked the Democratic nomination in the 1920s convention. They did not want Smith, in terms of his Catholic background. And they showed up and they intimidated people. They had enough support within the delegate that they could actually determine who was going to be the nominee of the party. And so you had that level. And that was because there were so many people who were either members of or sympathetic to the Klan. And so you had that reality in terms of somebody came across a bunch of Klan documents that began to really lay out just how many people were actually part of it, members of Congress, and that lots of top business people. And it was a very extensive and accepted component of the country in terms of the conservative operation and whatnot. And so it was a major and respected force within this country.
It was more than just the Klan, too. When you look at things like the massacre that happened in Tulsa, which is the one that people are most familiar with, that was part of a larger pattern of the same kind of thing. And then there was the smaller attacks. Like, I was interviewing a woman whose family, I want to say it was in Kentucky. They were black. They had a farm that was very successful. They had an ongoing business where they were selling their farm products. And white men just came in and shot everybody except this woman's either grandmother or great-grandmother dead, and then took over the farm. And it was completely allowed by everyone in the surrounding areas. So I can't even imagine what kind of world we're looking at if these kinds of things are allowed again. And no one's talking about this, or not effectively talking about
it. Well, correct. And that is one of the great challenges of this moment right now, that this is not being talked about in terms of it being called out. Yet the activities of this administration, and it should be pointed out that it's before even this administration that you had a lot of the backtracking and the weakening of resolve around addressing racial justice. There was a large sense of a racial reckoning after George Floyd was murdered in 2020. Lots of broad swaths of the society and its leadership were saying we had to do something about racism. And so that moment was when it crested. But then you had a lot of backtracking before even the 2024 election. So that is an important, I think, reality to note. And yet, when this administration came in 2025, both the speed and ferocity and precision of their efforts to undermine, undo, attack, and destroy any efforts that were designed to make this country a country, as Lincoln had talked about, one where all are created equal. Not only ignoring the level of inequality within the country, but attacking every effort to try to address that inequality. And so it's a very clear central component of the right wing, the MAGA community, this presidential administration's leadership is to attack and try to block and reverse the efforts that have seen the country become more diverse. And yet at the same time, you don't see people responding and calling it out for what it is. And there's far too much timidity and fear and silence on the part of progressives and the part of Democrats to name what is happening and to call it out and to try to refute it and rebut it.
Well, I think part of the reason that we're not seeing people being alarmed enough is because they haven't studied the history. And that's been purposeful. Ron DeSantis passed a law in Florida saying you couldn't teach anything that got people upset. And Florida had its own set of atrocities. What were the white primaries and how did that work to suppress the vote?
So, you're right. What I talk about in the book is how there's what I call basically a conservative battle plan that had different components to it. Never give an inch, ruthlessly rewrite the rules, distort public opinion, and silently sanction terrorism. It's the ruthlessly rewriting the rules and the laws. And so after the Civil War, you had the establishment of the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment. 15th Amendment designed to outlaw discrimination in voting. And yet, right away, you have people trying to narrow the reach of those rules. Yeah, that's how we got to separate but equal. People were saying, like, well, okay, you can't have segregation, but if it's equal, then it's not a problem. In that context, there are these efforts to be able to continue voter suppression and to continue voter suppression to protect white power within this country. In a number of states, Texas in particular, created whites-only primaries. But the only people who could vote in the Democratic primaries were white people. They would put forward the logics like, well, it's not that's not covered by the Constitution because that the parties are not government entities. They're actually private actors. They can do what they want. And as long as the general election, everybody can vote in the general election, then there's no discrimination. But particularly in the South, particularly South at that time, was really a one-party state and a one-party region of the country. So whoever won the Democratic nomination was the de facto elected official. And they argued this. It went on for like 20 years. They would bring it up to the Supreme Court. Supreme Court would send it back down. They would tweak it a little bit, continue it forward, have to argue it back up to the Supreme Court. And the people unapologetically defended and promoted and tried to say that only white people should be able to vote in the primaries, which is something that I didn't know. I think most people have no idea that this was a common practice within this country.
One of the tactics used by white supremacists is waging economic warfare, and often real estate is at the heart of that. Can you explain how home ownership was weaponized and how that played out in your own family?
So in my own family, and also I found out I share this experience actually with Cory Booker, who has talked about a similar experience. We're roughly similar age. Our parents were young adults in the 1960s in the context of the Civil Rights Movement. And so in terms of my family, I grew up in Cleveland Heights, Ohio, and my parents wanted to buy a home in Cleveland on Dartmoor Road, Cleveland Heights, Ohio, which is that time was an all-white street and relatively white neighborhood. My brother was the first black student at the local elementary school. And they had to wind up going to get a white civil rights lawyer to buy the home for them because that was the time of the free housing movement within the 1960s. Somebody had gone to that homeowner and talked to them, and they were basically giving racist and anti-Semitic comments about not wanting to sell the house to people who weren't desirable. And so my parents didn't think they would be able to get the house sold to them, enlist this white lawyer, Byron Krantz, to buy the house. Then he deeded it over to my parents. And I also give the example in my books about how there's the economic consequence of that. So that was in the Cleveland Heights neighborhood, which is a suburban area, et cetera. My grandparents lived approximately 2 or 3 miles from there in the city of Cleveland. And their house was worth just a fraction of what the house in the suburbs was. And so it's only because we were able to get that house in the suburbs that it had more equity in it that my family could then tap that home equity to be able to pay for me to go to a private high school to get the kind of education that give me more opportunities. But if we'd been denied that opportunity and been relegated to the home in the area that my grandparents were in, we would never have had that economic cushion to be able to open up more opportunities for me.
And that was part of the economic warfare. I don't think you mentioned this in the book, but I'm sure you're familiar with it. The discrimination over the GI benefits after World War II created a huge gap between the generational wealth of whites and blacks because white people were given this leg up for home ownership.
Oh, 100%, which is another thing that people don't actually understand. This is documented pretty well in some few different books. There's the Richard Rothstein's The Color of Law, and there's also the book When Affirmative Action Was White. in that, in essence, the middle class in this country was created because the United States took billions of dollars and handed it to white people, which is, in essence, what the GI Bill was. People coming back from war and their families were given money to start businesses, to go to college, and it was largely in practice, if not in the letter of the law, excluded black people from participating in that economic largesse. And so for all the wailing and gnashing of teeth about government handouts, the government handed out billions of dollars to white people after the World War II, which created much of the middle class and made the middle class as white as it is. And that was just done without any concern or hesitation, because that was the grouping that people actually wanted to have in place. So that the reality is that there's been active government action and public policy to perpetuate the reality of this primarily being a country for white people.
Gulf Coast Community Choir presents their annual concert on Sunday, May 3rd at 4 p.m. For more than 25 years, this volunteer group of multicultural singers have performed in the area to express unity through song and support other local community organizations. The theme of this year's concert is A Melodious Trip Down Memory Lane. The concert will take place at Trinity United Methodist Church, 4150 South Shade Avenue in Sarasota. More information is available at choir2025gccc.com. You're listening to The Progressive Page Turner. My guest is Steve Phillips, and we're talking about his book, How We Win the Civil War. In your book, you go over some of the tactics for building strong civic engagement, and organizations like Lucha in Arizona were able to do this. Who is Lucha? Why were they effective? And do you see any other organizations like that?
I do. It's very interesting now, because we're recording this right a couple weeks after Reverend Jesse Jackson passed away. And if you look at the arc of that journey of what Reverend said, he was with Martin Luther King, was literally with Martin Luther King when King was assassinated in the 1960s. And if you go back and read and study and watch history of that period, much of the thrust of the 60s civil rights movement was designed to highlight the inequality, to be able to challenge the conscience of the nation, to get people to move and to act. The U.S. was 12% people of color in the mid-1960s. It's 41% people of color now. And so what Reverend Jackson showed is that there's a new electoral majority that we could build that have to shift power from being able to have to just appeal to people to be able to just take power through a coalition. She said, the old minorities come together. It's a new majority. It's Rainbow Coalition, people of color and progressive whites. So that reality has unfolded. It unfolded in Georgia. That's what Stacey Abrams led over the course of 2012, really to 2020, when she started registering hundreds of thousands of voters in Georgia, which led to Reverend Raphael Warnock winning in 2020 and Biden winning Georgia in 2020. And you saw a similar situation in Arizona with Lucha. Arizona had a very hostile, anti-immigrant, really, frankly, pro-white citizen public policies. And they had the Show Me Your Papers law, SB 1070, which was directly targeting immigrants. It was the precursor to what we're seeing now with ICE happening across the country. And so activists came together. There's a camp out for weeks on the lawn at the Capitol in Arizona, where people were trying to make a moral witness to get the governor not to sign that bill, which she did, which then led people, it politicized and people to see that we have to become active. We have to register people to vote. And that's the seeds of Lucha. So Alex Gomez, who was one of the leaders of Lucha, was forged in that struggle on the lawn outside the Capitol, the governor's office, and then realizing they had to do voter registration. And so Lucha is a primary civic engagement organization in Arizona that has helped and been part of a coalition that's registered hundreds of thousands of people of color over the past decade and has changed the composition of the electorate within Arizona. You had a situation where that state defeated Trump in 2020. That state's elected a governor, a Democratic governor, Katie Hobbs, because the composition of the electorate has changed. And so that is one example you lift up. And there are other examples in different places. We're recording this on the day that the Texas primary is taking place. There's an organization in Texas, Texas Organizing Project, which is running what they call a Blacktop program. Their acronym is TOP, that's doing voter registration and voter mobilization across Texas to be able to change the composition of the electorate in Texas. Texas is seen as a conservative state. There are 5 million non-voting people of color in Texas. And so those kind of civic engagement organizations that have roots in the community and credibility and can do the work to bring non-voting people of color into the electorate represents the way to bring about transformation of politics in this country.
In the chapter on San Diego, you look at how conservative attacks on racial justice policies in the 1990s backfired. What happened there, and what effect do you think the ICE raids are going to have on the midterms? There's got to be a lot of blowback from that.
There is. And so a similar situation in California and in Arizona. California had a very aggressive, anti-immigrant, anti-people of color, pro-white nationalist, frankly, set of public policies in the early 90s. And so the anti-affirmative action measure, Prop 209 passed, there was anti-immigration law, Prop 187, and anti-bilingual education. Early 90s. There's a whole book written about this by Professor Jewel Taylor Gibbs called Preserving Privilege. And it was really about trying to preserve white privilege, this whole series of public policies. But that led to one of the main leaders in San Diego, Andrea Guerrero, was a lawyer in that area, and she was at Berkeley's law school during the time of the anti-affirmative action measures, to become a real leader down in San Diego to help to forge a coalition to bring people of color into the electorate, change the composition of the electorate, and flip the political balance of power in San Diego. They went from majority Republican city council to a 9-0 Democratic city council over the course of about 8 to 10 years. And so that's a real example of both this backlash, but this the hostility and the attacks then awakening people who had not been as politically active before and giving greater clarity. And this is exactly what's happening in the country now. And it's exactly what's happening with ICE and then particularly within Minnesota, that it has clarified for people and shown that the level of not even just hostility, but it's like they're actually killing United States citizens who are simply trying to hold their government to account. All these amassed ICE agents are public employees paid for with public dollars from the majority of the federal money, by the way, comes from Democratic states. And so we have such a perverse situation. But people's eyes have been more open and they're more outraged and alarmed. And we're seeing a repudiation of this government happening. Even early election results in terms of Texas and North Carolina, there is historic levels of turnout of voters, of Democratic voters turning out in larger number than Republican voters, which is really what happened in 2025 as well. It's a reflection of the national outrage and repudiation of the direction and priorities of this administration.
So much of our elections is actually determined by money. And during his second inauguration, Trump was surrounded by billionaires, and he made it really clear who he is going to be fighting for. Basically, Elon Musk bought his way into the government. Do you see any way of effectively fighting this?
I do. One of the more promising developments in the history of this country over the past decade, we've had two twin parallel revolutions of the demographic revolution and the technological revolution. And so the technological revolution has done is it has enabled small dollar regular people to band together, to pool their resources, to be able to have the kinds of resources necessary to counteract the billionaires and the Elon Musk of the world. And one of the clearest example of that was, you know, Bernie Sanders' campaign, right? Was this, I think it was average contribution of $29, something like that. And he raised a couple hundred million dollars in that fashion. So a strong, clear message that harnesses the technological tools that are available so people can pool together small dollars in a much more efficient way than you were able to in the past shows you can counteract big money. And I think that's also the lesson of the New York mayoral election. This is really what Mamdani did. That's the center of capitalism within this country, within this world, is New York City. and they did not want Mondami to be the mayor. But he was able to inspire and pool together excited, coordinated people pulling small dollars to counteract the big dollars that the billionaires are throwing around.
Let's talk about Texas. I didn't realize how much slavery shaped Texas history, but it was at the heart of its founding, wasn't it?
Oh, 100%. And people don't realize that either. The leaders of Texas in like the 1830s wanted to be able to continue to practice slavery. And that is why they had the original Texas Revolution to create the Republic of Texas. The primary issue was that the white people in that area could practice slavery. And then the United States federal government came in support of that, led to the Mexican-American War. The United States took the majority of the landmass of Mexico from Mexico in that war. And it was all about, are we going to be able to practice slavery? And I talk in the book about Sam Houston, through whom the city of Houston is named, was a slave owner and an unapologetic slave owner. And so the very DNA of the creation of Texas was about preserving slavery and about continuing the practice and this concept that this should be a white country.
The demographics of Texas have changed greatly. You referenced that a little bit earlier. Do you think there's a good possibility of Texas becoming a Democratic majority? And part of the problem, too, I think, is there's parts of the Democratic Party that are so aligned with the conservatives that you start to wonder, is this really going to be a good change? But we have two really strong candidates in Jasmine Crockett and Tallarico. Do you think it's possible to get a more progressive government in Texas?
Absolutely. And that's why there's so much ferocity of voter suppression in a place like Texas. The popular conception of Texas is a, you know, cowboy hat wearing white conservative who has conservative politics. But I like to say that Texas is more actually about Beyonce, who's from Houston, and about the Latino cultural figures. Texas as a state, its state population is 61% people of color. Its eligible voter population is 51% people of color. And you've got a solid third or so of the white population who are progressive. The problem is that people don't vote, and there's a lot of voter suppression, voter misinformation, and discouragement in that regard. Beto O'Rourke, when he ran in 2018 for Senate, and he became famous by standing up for Black Lives Matter and for the protests NFL football players were making, he came within 215,000 votes of winning that election. It's the closest the Democrats have come in 30 years. There were almost 5 million people of color who did not vote in that election. So the numbers are there if people are inspired and mobilized and invested in and organized to turn out the population. You were mentioning that the people in the Democratic Party are aligned with conservatives. I was going to say, I was thinking that people in the Democratic Party can't count. And so if you understand that you have the support among the part of the voting population which is not inspired or invested in. And I actually ran these numbers. If every single eligible voter in Texas had voted in 2020, and then you apportioned the votes by racial group according to the percentages that the exit polls showed people would get, Joe Biden would have beaten Trump in 2020 within Texas, because it's a voter mobilization issue. So that's what's encouraging about this year. There's been so much significant enthusiasm and turnout, and hopefully party leaders and major donors will continue to invest in the infrastructure to be able to maximize voter participation among the full rainbow of people within the state's population. The MAGA crowd and the right wing actually are better at math, because they understand that if they have large voter turnout, that they're actually going to lose, which is why they try to exclude and obscure and suppress and whatnot. So there's always going to be stuff that we can actually point to. I do believe that even though somebody was, they were saying, you know, Trump's like, oh, I might win for a third term, whatever. My first thought was, oh, so we're still going to have elections, right? And so to the extent that we're having elections, a lot of these elections take place in states and even in counties, even in a place like Texas, you have Democratic-run counties where most of the votes are. I believe that if we have a progressive crusade for civic participation and voting, that we can overcome these types of voter suppression and manifest the power of a new American majority, despite all the nefarious things that the right wing is doing to suppress the vote.
Yeah. You've been listening to The Progressive Page Turner. My guest has been Steve Phillips, and we've been talking about his book, How We Win the Civil War. Steve, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me. I really enjoyed the conversation.